You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Ricardo Lagos was the president of Chile from 2000 to 2006, a time of great growth and change in that country. In his new book, The Southern Tiger, Chile's Fight for a Democratic and Prosperous Future, he chronicles his country's journey from terror and repression under General Augusto Pinochet to a thriving open society, and from widespread poverty to becoming one of the wealthiest nations in Latin America. The book is published by Palgrave Macmillan, and I'm very pleased that it has brought President Ricardo Lagos to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you very much for this invitation.
Now, most military dictators don't allow free and open elections. How did Chilean citizens gain the chance to vote Pinochet out of office?
Well, I think because there has been two plebiscites before that with no electoral register and with no the usual things, you know. And Pinochet's attempt was to remain in power after the constitution was approved during 16 years. And somebody told him, but don't you think, General, that is too much, 16 years? Why don't you have a plebiscite in the middle? And that was the origin of this, after 8 years, a plebiscite.
But usually those elections are rigged, aren't they?
Of course. And the question was that they set up a constitutional tribunal, and the constitutional tribunal decided that was not possible because Chile had a long-standing democratic tradition that was not possible to have a plebiscite without citizens being registered, without, quote-unquote, legal political parties, and without then somebody from those political parties watching how you're going to count the votes.
But many of his opponents were killed during his time in power. Were you and other political activists concerned for your safety?
Well, at that particular time, yes.
I mean,
I was in prison and they went to my house. I was living in a condominium. The door was also open, and that was right after an attempt against Pinochet's life. And when I turned the lights on in my bedroom at 2 o'clock in the morning, 6 guns were pointing me. It's not the best way to wake up.
Were they accusing you of being part of the plot?
They wanted to accuse me of being something like the intellectual, guy behind that. No?
You were stirring up opposition.
Yeah, I was very much in the opposition of Pinochet, but everybody knows that my opposition was that we wanted to recover democracy through nonviolent means.
Now, was it significant that you were arrested by the regular police investigators rather than by Pinochet's secret police?
Yes, because those that were, unfortunately, a journalist that was arrested by the secret police appeared murdered the following day. And I was lucky enough that when they arrived to my house, they said, "Don't worry, Mr. Lagos, we are professionals." I didn't understand what they mean by professional, because I say, "But look, I know, but what kind of professionals are you? Give me your order of arrest." And they say, "Come on, Mr. Lagos, you understand. Please go with us."
But they were kind of telling you that you were going to survive this.
And then when I arrived to the headquarters of the police that was well known in Chile, of course, it's the same headquarters that they had today. They say, "You see, we are professional. This is our building."
How long were you in prison?
Oh, a rather short time. It was about 3 weeks, because at that time it was very close to the next General Assembly here in New York, and Pinochet was isolated from all democratic countries, and they have a tremendous quote-unquote victory. Chilean foreign minister was going to have a meeting with all the, at that time, 9 or 10 foreign ministers from the European Union, and this was presented as a tremendous successful. And when the foreign minister arrived in New York, the Spanish foreign minister said, "I will not be there because Mr. Lagos is in prison." And that was the end, because the others say, "As long as Lagos is in prison, we are not going to meet with you." The result, I was sent to my house.
Because they wanted the respect of the rest of the world.
That's right.
Which would have been kind of difficult at that time. Chile was already considered something of a pariah nation.
Yes, of course. That was true. I mean, we received this solidarity all over the world. And let me tell you, at that time also, there has been a change. We are talking about 1986, even from the U.S. government. That was Ronald Reagan, as you know. But they changed the policy towards Chile, yeah.
So we have this situation where you have a very repressive government,
yeah.
And now the plebiscite is going to be held. Is there suddenly total freedom in the country?
No, of course not. Of course not. But more important than that, people has fear. They used to think that there's going to be some satellite and they're going to be able to see if you say yes or no to Pinochet's plebiscite. And therefore, our task was to convince them that if we organize ourselves from the grassroots of Chilean society, we were able to control the plebiscite and we were able to have our own counting, which we did, and we were able also to go to TB because we are going to be legal political parties, which what we did.
And in fact, I get a feeling that one of the turning points was when you were on a panel discussion on national television and you looked directly at the camera and challenged Pinochet to honor the plebiscite.
Yes, I say Pinochet.
Is that something you'd rehearsed? Had you figured out you were going to say that before, or was that spontaneous?
Well, what happened was that I figured out before, but working with a small crowd in a small city close to Santiago. And at that time was the first time that somebody gave me, during those days we used the telex, remember, the cable. And there was a cable of Pinochet talking in the northern part of Chile. And among others say, I know that there is somebody called Lagos. Be careful, we are watching you. And they gave me that, and I say to the people, I'm going to use this. So I went to the podium when I spoke, and I say, look, now you're going to be quiet because I'm going to read you something from Pinochet. Ooh, people say. So I read that to Pinochet. And then just suddenly I decided to say, I'm from here, from this city. I answered you, Augusto Pinochet, 1, 2, 3. And was magic, you know? People stand up. The fact that I discovered that to address it straight to him was a very strong question. So when I went to that TV station with three other persons of my party, we had rehearsed very carefully, very professionally, what are we going to say? Because we told them, the people, look, if you dare to sign for our party, we will become, quote-unquote, legal party. And therefore, then, we can be in a position to communicate to the rest of the country. So we decided that we have to be very strong, very firm in our conviction, not to be afraid of. And it pays.
My guest is Ricardo Lagos, former president of Chile, who's written with the help of Foreign Policy's Blake Hounshell and Elizabeth Dickinson, The Southern Tiger, Chile's Fight for a Democratic and Prosperous Future. It has a foreword by Bill Clinton. And I wonder how important Bill Clinton's support was, because when Pinochet came to power, he had the support of Richard Nixon. Had American foreign policy changed that much that he now felt like he didn't have our support?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, needless to say, Pinochet had the support that after the coup of the U.S. government, Pinochet has the support, all the credits were going again to Chile, etc., etc. Nevertheless, I would say that during Reagan's second term, they thought that probably it was better to bet the cards in favor of the future democratic institutions of Chile. Pinochet was quite isolated. There was a lot of protest in Chile, very much like what you have here in the Arab Spring. And therefore, we tried to channel, you know, those protests in such a way, and we succeeded.
Also, U.S. Attitudes changed a bit when we had an assassination right here in Washington obviously was connected to Pinochet.
Well, of course, the assassination was connected with, and he knew that, because there were attempts against permanent opposition from figures in Buenos Aires, in Rome, in Italy, and here in the DuPont Circle in Washington. And that, of course, make the United States suspicious. But then, I would say, it was very important in 1986, the changes. In fact, you know, when I was in prison, the first visitor that I received was somebody from the American Embassy. It was quite surprising for me, you know. And he said, well, Mr. Lagos, I'm here just to make sure that you are alive and well, and I will report my government. In other words, if something happened, it's going to be the responsible of those that have you here. Yeah.
Now, you mentioned the Arab Spring. When you were watching the Arab Spring unfold and what's happening a year later in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia, what are your thoughts about those countries and the transitions taking place there? It seems like it's not as smooth as we would have fantasized.
No, it's not. Those things are not smooth. But at the same time, you have to be prepared to two things. How are you going to be able to put the generals back in the barracks where they are supposed to be? And how are you going to convince them that because they had the monopoly of power, the force, well, the how and when are you going to use that monopoly belongs to the civilian people in charge of the country.
So when you look at Egypt right now, where the military is trying to hold on to some power and there's pressure for a totally civilian government, do you see similarities to what happened?
Of course, of course.
The military, even after the fall of Pinochet, still wanted to be pretty much in control
in
Chile?
Well, in fact, you know, according to Pinochet's constitution, Pinochet remained as commander-in-chief of the army during 8 years. I used to say to my Spanish friends, look, you did what you did after Franco was dead, but we have to do it with Franco alive, you know?
And running the military, which is the most powerful force in the country.
The powerful force. So when I arrived in 2000, Pinochet was gone, but Pinochet was still a senator for life, because Pinochet's constitution says former president will be senator for life. I make a lot of changes in the constitution, and one of the changes was to abrogate that, so I'm not a senator for life, of course.
Well, by being senator for life, he was protected against any legal prosecution,
wasn't he? That's right, that was. And I'm happy to say that during the first 3 or 4 months after being elected, the judiciary stripped of Pinochet of his immunity, and he was prosecuted by several crimes. And then, in 2003, it became known in Chile of the secret bank accounts of Pinochet here in the United States with different names and different alias, you know, like a criminal. And that produced a tremendous impact in Chilean society. Yeah.
Now, why did you decide not to run for president in the first election after he fell from power?
Well, I was such a strong figure against Pinochet that I thought that if I accepted what many people say, you should run for president right now, I say, well, this is like having a red flag to
bull.
A bull in Spain, you know, because you have to. And I say, we are going to put in jeopardy this kind of transition. Probably a Christian Democrat is going to be much more palatable from the point of view of the military. And I think that sometimes if you are a public figure, I know that this is very easy to say. You have to put first the interest of the country, of your own interest. But you have to meaning.
So you wound up taking over the educational ministry.
Yeah.
Now, a listener just left a comment on our show page. He said, Mr. Lagos set the current education policy in Chile. Can you please ask him how he feels about the thousands of students who have been in the streets and in the schools for the past year protesting those elite policies which exclude 99% of the population from higher education?
Yeah, well, I'm so glad that the question came out, because first of all, those students are the sons and daughters of a democratic country. They were born in 1990, 20 years ago. Number two, in today's Chile, of 10 university students, 7 is first generation in their families. Now, the point is that in order to have a growth in enrollment from 200,000 to 1.1 million in just 20 years has been a tremendous burden. And the problem is that most of that money is being paid in very high tuitions by the families. And this is the problem. Now, it's different when you have a $5,000 per capita income, 10,000 or 16 like today. So I would say that today they have all the reason to be on the streets in order to demand public education or at least a public involvement in order to make possible for all of them to remain at the university.
We have to take a little break. When we come back, let's talk about the economy and the changes. My guest is Ricardo Lagos, former president of Chile. He's written a book called The Southern Tiger, Chile's Fight for a Democratic and Prosperous Future. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. We're back with Ricardo Lagos, who was president of Chile from 2000 to 2006. He's the former UN Special Envoy for Climate Change, and these days he spends a little time here at Brown University as a professor at large. He's written a book with the help of Blake Hounshell and Elizabeth Dickinson of Foreign Policy magazine called The Southern Tiger, Chile's Fight for a Democratic and Prosperous Future, published by Palgrave Macmillan. You note that, and in fact, you kind of referred to it just a little while ago, that when Pinochet left office in 1989, the average annual income in Chile was $5,000 behind Argentina and Uruguay. By 2010, it was $15,000, now it's $16,000, a substantial improvement. But you also point out that the inequality has also grown in the society. Can you talk a bit about what that means for society and what are the best ways to deal with that inequality?
Well, I think that the question is extremely important because you can reduce people living under the poverty line, which is very important. This is the major point in the agenda. You have 40% of the people living under the poverty. This is the first thing that you have to address. But to address and to be successful does not mean necessarily that distribution of income is going to be more equal. And it's true. We improve distribution of income, which is extremely unequal in Chile because of social benefits that were carried out by the government. When you have a free breakfast and lunches at school of 2.5 million students, at least 1.5 need to have some breakfast and lunch. When you have a minimum social security pension, or when you have some health access to those that cannot afford, or when you have some social housing that is, I mean, when you take all those things in consideration, you reduce about half the uneven distribution of income. Nevertheless, it's still very uneven. So I would say, look, there is a close correlation between as you are increasing per capita income, you are solving some economic and social problems. Nevertheless, for instance, you increase the life expectancy, you reduce infant mortality, etc., etc. But when you are above 20,000, and this is very important in this country, when you are above 20,000, the major social and economic indicators doesn't relate to income per capita, relates to income distribution. And the fact then is that from the point of view of Chile, the number one question today is income distribution. And I think that in many developed countries also is becoming, when you have a movement like the 99%, what that means?
Well, Pinochet introduced Milton Friedman's economic theories to Chile. And many people would say they strengthen the economy. Friedman called it the miracle of Chile.
Well, I think he called miracle because he thought that miracle means to have growth. But I would say you cannot have growth if at the same time you are not able to have equity with growth. And that means that part of that growth has to mean a better school, a better primary health care, a better housing, and that is then something that has to be solved by the citizens. Let me put it this way. When you have a market-oriented economy, that market-oriented economy is produced because of the consumers, a society very uneven. You need to have a society molded by citizens. All of us are citizens, and all of us count as one person.
Now, another listener left this comment. Please ask Mr. Lagos about the current state of Chile's social security system. Is it still viable in our current stagnant global economy? I recall many politicians here in the United States heralded it as a possibility for private retirement accounts in place of the Social Security system that we have?
I would like to make just two comments, because this question arises many times with President Bush. So he asked me about that. I say, Mr. President, you have to be careful for two reasons. First one, you will have to keep paying those that are close to retirement and that already retire, because now you pay them with those that are given money from the active workers today. So if you want that the active workers will have their own capital accounts, that means that the state will have to take the bill for those that already retire or close to retirement. It's quite an amount of money. Number two, either because in Chile wages are rather low or because there are some periods of unemployment, the fact is that 50%, listen to me, 50% of future retirement will need to have a solidarity pillar by the government, because the amount that they have saved is going to be enough for a minimum pension for the next 8 years, and then what? Or for the next 5 years, and then what? Or for the next 10 years. That depends how much saving you have. But the fact is that if you go to retirement at 65, and now the average age in Chile is up close to 80, well, if you are going to get a pension for the next 6 or 7 years, who is going to pay you then?
Do you think that President Bush was convinced? Because you had other run-ins with him involving the war in Iraq.
Yeah, of course. That was another thing, a funny story about that. But I would say I'm not sure if President Bush was convinced, but at least he listened very carefully when I explained this to you. I mean, I know that in the country many people are saying, look what is going on in Chile. But I would say, well, yeah, I know. But in order that the system work in Chile, only 50% can afford a better pension. The other 50 will need money coming from the government.
So is the private retirement still in place in Chile, or have you returned to some other system?
No, because my successor, President Bachelet, has to introduce a change and to guarantee, from the point of view of government, the minimum pension. And this is what they call the solidarity pillar. Without the solidarity pillar, the system is not going to work.
You promoted more social spending and more taxes for the wealthiest citizens in Chile. Are there particular countries that you think do this well? And you must be aware of the bitter debate in this country where people are arguing over whether adding taxes to the wealthy actually help the economy.
Well, I think that the real issue here, if we are going to be and to say things as they are, is that during the last 30 years, the 1% higher income recipients in this country has increased the share of national income from 9% to 25%. And this is, of course, at the expense of the other 99% that so reduce the share nationally from 91 to what we have now. So I think that this is a real issue in this country. And number two...
Well, you try to raise taxes.
Well, I tried, but it
wasn't so easy.
Because it's not easy, because right-wing parties in Chile, we have a very unusual electoral system, so I wouldn't like to go to that detail. But the fact is that, in practical terms, I have no majority in Congress during all my administration. So whenever I pass some taxes... We reduce evasion, we reduce illusion, but that means we increase taxes through evasion, but not because, and sometimes we have to increase a little bit the value-added tax, but the value-added tax is not a very fair tax, you know.
My guest is Ricardo Lagos. His book, The Southern Tiger, Chile's Fight for a Democratic and Prosperous Future, is published by Palgrave Macmillan. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that Chile has a resource curse. Aren't natural resources a good thing for a country?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a good thing if you don't use it in the right way. What I say is you are fortunate enough to have that, like we have copper, then I say it's necessary to understand that the revenues coming from copper has to be invested in such a way that when you don't have copper anymore, then you still will have resources like innovation, knowledge, scholarships. Those are the things that when you have no copper anymore. We have always been a mining country.
Copper is like oil in the Middle East.
In the Middle East.
For Chile, yes. It's copper.
It's copper. And I introduced the rule that you have to use and spend money according to the long-term trends in copper price and not the actual. So that when the copper price is very low, you can spend a little bit more. But when it's very high, you have to save. And this rule has been accepted by the governments, and this is why we have quite a substantial money now saved from copper.
Were you able to attract foreign investors?
Oh, yes. There's quite a number. Chile is very stable. The rule of law exists in Chile. The three powers are quite independent, one to each other. And we are rather well known by our democratic institutions.
Well, has Chile been affected by the economic crisis that has pretty much affected most of the world?
Probably because we were guilty of so many economic crises in the past. Now we can say, in this case, we are innocent. But more important than that, because we have so many crises in the past, our financial system is much more regulated than in the U.S., and that is the reason why, or the Europe, and that's the reason why our financial system has resisted very well the crisis. And number two, I would say that we have been able to have, in Chile this year, a growth of about 5%. This year, 2012, is going to be about 4%. And therefore, I think that we will perform rather better than many other parts of the world. Not only Chile, but Latin America or South America in general.
And our economy right here in the United States. Another listener asks if you can address what he calls a sellout of your country's politicians in regard to mining interests. Foreign industry wants to put up dams in Patagonia that will destroy one of the last pristine wildernesses on Earth and the second largest untrammeled watershed outside of Greenland.
Yeah. Well, I think that with regard to that, you know, first of all, energy, clean energy now is extremely important, and needless to say, the hydro energy is extremely clean. The problem with that is how much are you going to affect that pristine area of the country, and to what extent then environmentalists can be satisfied in their demands. And number two, the major problem now is how are you going to take that energy further south to the central part of Chile? It's going to be a line of about more than 1,000 miles, you know. Now, the big issue is, well, how get your electricity here in New York? How many miles you take electricity coming from Canada in order to have a rather clean one? And therefore, I would say, look, I think that it's necessary to balance very carefully those two things. Other than that, I would say, Chile has a tremendous resource. The northern part of Chile is a desert, and everybody agrees that it's a part of the planet where you receive sun rays in such an intensity that should be the new future energy for Chile.
And solar energy.
Yeah, and solar energy, of course. And this is very important. Why? Because in that part of the country is where you have the mines of copper. They require a lot of electricity. And let me tell you, in the future, copper is not going to be a commodity. Copper is going to be a different thing depending how much carbon emission per ton of copper you have. So you have two or three prices for copper depending on carbon emission. And this is something that Chile has to be ahead of.
You've served as special envoy to the UN Secretary General on climate negotiation.
Oh, yeah.
And developing nations complain that the developed nations have already despoiled the environment, and now they're saying, well, Chile, you shouldn't be doing something similar as you try to develop.
Well, I know that argument, and I will add just a little bit of to be careful. Those that arrive later has different technology in our service. And therefore, I would say, please, if you are able to give me some intellectual property rights with regard to the new technology, then I may be able to have a different path to my own energy. By the way, these lamps here in this studio, you know, has nothing to do with the old lamps that used to produce 99%, 95% color and only 5% light. So I would say this is going to be very important.
Just one more thing. Later on in the show, we'll be discussing the Reporters Without Borders Global Index of Press Freedoms for this year, and the United States has dropped. But Chile has been dropped 47 places to number 80 on the list. The report says, in Chile, where student protesters questioned the overconcentration of media ownership, violence against journalists included beating, cyber attacks, and attacks on editorial staffs. Many of these assaults, often accompanied by heavy-handed arrests and destruction of equipment, were carried out by abusive armed police who were rarely called to account.
Well, I think that very recent report has necessarily made us Chileans to think about. I have always complained the concentration of media in just a few hands, and more important, the fact that those hands has a very clear thinking.
Were they in support of Pinochet in the old days?
Well, in the old days, the only press that can support was only... There really was some few others, but most of the press was in support of Pinochet. And now I would say we have two major chains of the media in Chile, particularly the written press, and those are very right-wing-oriented, I would say, at least in support of the actual government. So I think that it probably has been our fault that not to have another more independent press, but the fact is also that whenever there had been some independent press, they have been quite unable to get some advertising. And all of us know that it's very difficult to finance a paper only for the price of the paper.
And the Internet doesn't have the same power in Chile that it does in other places?
Well, of course. Well, that's the big issue today. When you have those people demonstrated, when the government say to one of them, it's forbidden to do that demonstration today, one of the leaders of the student movement went to Twitter at 12 o'clock at noon, and at 8 o'clock that night, most of the Chileans were melting pot, you know, as a protest because they say no to the students. So there is no question that the so-called Arab Spring is not only a spring in the Arab countries. I would say the Internet Spring, the new technological platform, you know, are changing the way. And I think that if you don't listen to that, then you are going to have many problems. So I think that the report that you mentioned is very important from our own point of view.
Ricardo Lagos is former president of Chile. He's written with the help of Blake Hounshell and Elizabeth Dickinson of Foreign Policy magazine a book called The Southern Tiger, Chile's Fight for a Democratic and Prosperous Future. It has a foreword by Bill Clinton, and it is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks a lot, sir. It was a pleasure to be here with you.